It's still morning, so good morning to both of you, and happy that you're here. And we are prepared to proceed, so go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Kevin Conaboy representing the appellants Christina and Douglas Knapp. I would request 2 minutes be reserved for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. As the court is aware, this matter is an appeal from the dismissal of the case in the Middle District of Pennsylvania by Judge Mannion. Judge Mannion determined that the filing of a writ of summons in Pennsylvania County Court was insufficient to toll the statute of limitations under the Federal Tort Claims Act. The factual background of the case, the plaintiffs allege...
No, please.
With that, but can we just jump in? Obviously, it may make a difference if we have state or federal law governing here in terms of when an action commences. And we had asked you, both counsel, to take a look at a number of cases coming from some different contexts that dealt with questions about commencement under federal versus state law. Can you speak to those? And should we think about this as analogous to diversity cases, to CAFA? What do you make of those cases that we've cited to you?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the important case to look at is the Supreme Court's decision in Herb versus Pitcairn in 1945, where in that case, which was a case under the Federal Employers Liability Act, the court said that when process is adequate to bring the parties into court and start the case on a course of judicial handling, which may lead to final judgment without the issuance of new initial process, it is enough to commence an action under the federal statute. And when you look at this case, it is our position that the filing of the writ of summons in Pike County Court brought the parties into court and started the matter on a course of judicial handling, which was sufficient to bring the matter ultimately to a decision.
Well, are you answering my question then by saying it doesn't matter if federal or state law applies? Because even if federal law applies, we should use the rule of that case to mean that here, where the substantive cause of action is one under state law, not federal law, as it was in Herb v. Pitcairn, that it would still be commencement as of the precipice?
I think that it doesn't matter either way. I think that a case that's removed from Pennsylvania state court that is initiated by writ of summons, whether it's diversity jurisdiction, whether it's jurisdiction under a federal statute, once the case is initiated or commenced, that the Pennsylvania rules of civil procedure are specific in the language that they use. And Judge Phipps in the last argument said statutory construction is important. When you look at the statute, the rule 1007 of the Pennsylvania rules of civil procedure gives the plaintiffs the option to commence an action, either A, by the filing of a writ of summons, or B, by the filing of a complaint. So whether it's a case that's removed for diversity jurisdiction, whether it's a case that's removed under a federal statute, I don't think that it matters. I think that once the action is commenced, it leads us on that process through the court system without the requirement of new initial process being filed and served.
Well, what is the right answer? I mean, as we study this question and are making pronouncements that may be relied upon beyond this case, when we're dealing with the FTCA, should we be thinking about this as the question of commencement as a state question under state law or under federal law? Which is the right way to think about it?
I think the case law says, that's been cited in our briefs, that and that the court has actually directed us to, the cases say that federal law applies once it gets into federal court, but until that point, state law applies.
Let me just follow up on that. I'm going to the text of 42 U.S.C. 233C, and it talks about any such civil action or proceeding commenced in state court, and that talks about the removal part of it. So this federal statute talks about commenced in state court. It would be strange to me if this statute was not focused on the state court, didn't kind of reference or assume that state court process would apply for how to commence, because it provides no definition of commence, and then it's the state courts that decide how to commence. And Pennsylvania is kind of unusual with this notion of this precipice that can commence an action, and then the defendant, if no complaint has been filed, can then file its own precipice, I believe. And then if they do that, then there's 20 days for a complaint. That's its own. I'm not aware of too many other states, any, that have that kind of ping pong back and forth in terms of how something gets commenced. It would be strange at one level if this removal provision then said, hey, forget what it takes to commence in state court. We think that there's some different federal standard that would work here. What do you think? I mean, is it because it's used in a federal statute, using a federal standard, or is it referencing or assuming the application of state standards since it says state courts?
I would agree, Your Honor, that because it's referencing commencement in the state court, you have to look to the state rules for how actions are commenced. I think it's important to understand as well, and one of the issues that the court sent in its recent correspondence concerning the issues for today was whether a complaint constitutes new initial process. And I would submit that a complaint filed in state court after an action is commenced with the filing of a writ of summons does not constitute new initial process. When you think about it, when you file your writ of summons, there's a filing fee. That writ of summons then needs to be, in Pennsylvania, directed to the sheriff or in Philadelphia to some adult who can serve it. It has to be, the process, which is the writ at that point, has to be served by the sheriff or the adult in Philadelphia.
And not to interrupt, but just to look at the mechanics of what a court does, this statute speaks of civil action. When that first precipice is filed, a state court assigns a civil action number to it.
Exactly.
It doesn't say, oh, hey, no case number. You now have a case number, so if you subsequently file a complaint, you know the case number that complaint goes to. So it would be very strange at one level to say, I filed something, precipice, got a civil action number, but that did not commence a civil action.
And I agree. That was you jumped on my next point.
Sorry.
That's okay. You make my job a little easier by doing that, so I appreciate it. So when you file, you get a civil action number, you pay your filing fee, it's sent to the sheriff serves it on the defendant. At that point, if you choose to file a complaint on your own timing or terms, you can do so. But again, no new filing fee, no new docket number is required.
Let me ask you a question. In the absence of the filing of a complaint, can you proceed to final judgment with merely the precipice, the writ of summons?
In the absence of the filing of a complaint, I would say no, Your Honor, you cannot proceed to final judgment. But there's a mechanism through the filing of a rule to file a complaint whereby the defense, after being served with the writ that notifies them that they've been sued, says, what's this all about? They file a precipice in the court called a rule to file a complaint. The prothonotary signs it. It's sent to the plaintiff's counsel, and the plaintiff then has 20 days to file their complaint or suffer a default judgment.
I thought that, and correct me if I'm wrong, one takeaway from Pitcairn 1, I guess, is that you do need the complaint, because what Pitcairn said was it has to be something that could take you to final judgment. Am I not reading the case correctly?
And Your Honor, respectfully, I think that what Pitcairn says is that it starts the case on a course of judicial handling which may lead to final judgment. So the filing of the writ starts the case on that court, on that course. The filing of the writ is that first step. There may be other steps along the way which are required in order to get to final judgment, but the writ, I would submit, starts the case on that course that can lead or may lead to final judgment.
Let's accept for the moment that we're looking at the date of the precipi filing as a commencement. So when it comes to exhaustion, here we've got presentment of the complaint to the county before the two-year mark, the actual receipt by HHS afterwards, but a statute that indicates that that those who are considered covered are to be deemed employees of the public health service. Should we then, under the statute, consider the county agent Pike or the employee who receives it to be essentially the federal agency itself?
I don't think that's the position that we took at the district court level, and I think it would be disingenuous of me to take that position now. At the district court level, our position was that we recognized, and for the purpose of the filing of the filing of the writ and then taking it through its procedure, we recognized at the district court level that there was an issue with the timing of the service of the, I think it's SF-95 form on the Department of Human Services. And that's why at the district court level, we indicated that we would concur in the relief requested by the United States that the case be dismissed for failure to exhaust administrative remedies, so long as that dismissal was done without prejudice, so as to allow the plaintiffs the opportunity under the Westfall Act Savings Clause to then file their SF-95 form.
Well, let's get to that in a second, but sure. Are you saying it was presented too late or that it wasn't presented at all?
Am I saying that the SF-95 form was presented too late? In the first case, the first NAP matter that came before this court, as I'm sure Your Honors are aware, there was a first case that came through filed in federal court that was dismissed for the failure to exhaust, or I guess it was really for the statute of limitations issue. In this case, the filing of when the writ was filed to commence the action, exhaustion had not occurred because we were unaware.
But is
frankly,
I'm so sorry. Yeah. I'm going to interrupt you. Yeah. I'm going to listen intently. I just want the answer to her question.
Sure. So in the case that brings us here today, when the case was originally commenced, the SF-95 form had not been filed at all with anyone. But and then when it was filed, it was filed with the doctor's office. It was sent to the doctor's office, not filed.
Right,
it was presented to the doctor's office.
Pike's not the federal agency.
Correct.
For these purposes.
Correct.
Yeah?
Correct. And I think that that's what they...
So it gets transferred, but it gets into the hands of HHS eventually. Is it your position that it was presented, but late, unless you get the benefit of the Westfall Act, or that it was never, it's never been presented to the federal agency for exhaustion purposes?
It eventually made its way to the Department of Human Services, so I guess technically it was presented to them, but late, but on the original filing, the commencement of the action, the it had not been presented at the time that the action was commenced.
Can I jump in now?
Yeah.
Okay. So my question goes to this. The whole point of this, 233 is about kind of substitution, or maybe not substitution, but deeming. And so what happens is there's two types of certification that have to happen under 233. One is one done by the Secretary of HHS, and the Secretary of HHS says, hey, I deem this federal medical, this medical center that receives federal funds and all its employees, and the deeming certificate's in the record, to be a federal employee, right?
Right.
That's what it says. So why isn't sending it to that medical center sufficient to present it to the agency, because that medical center is deemed to be a federal agency, a federal employee? So I don't know why you're kind of saying, hey, it was late, because there's a certification in the record that says that medical center, for purposes of this act, is a federal employee. So it seems that you didn't, I mean, I don't know why you think that you messed up, because you sent it to an entity that's deemed to be a federal employee, and we have a certification in the record that's, yes, we treat them as a federal employee.
Well, and if your honors want to decide that that was an appropriate service on them, and that it can be saved by the Westfall Act.
But not, it doesn't even need to. Yet. I mean, let me just ask another question, and this is more fundamental, and something I've really struggled with. Why does exhaustion apply here? I have no idea why it applies. It's not provided in 233. 233 vicariously references some provisions of Title 28, but we know from Hui V. Castaneda that a general reference to Title 28 doesn't cut it. That was a 233A case, but the proposition is still the same. A general reference doesn't cut it. And so why is presentment required? I mean, we have all these other provisions in the FTCA, like 2679D4, that says, oh, hey, all the other limitations of the FTCA apply. But that's not, no one wrote that in to Section 233. So I'm struggling to find, we have this exhaustion, we have this presentment requirement for FTCA claims, but I don't see why it applies here. Maybe that's more a question for adversary, but you seem to have stipulated to it, and so I'm wondering why you did.
Well, I think that our reading of the case law indicates that it appeared to apply, but if you disagree, that's fine with me.
Well, there are cases that you rely on that would lead one to believe that serving Pike is not serving a federal agency. That's your point, yeah?
I think that's correct. I mean, when you look at the case law, if you're involved in an accident with a postal worker, you don't serve your SF-95 on that postal worker. You serve the SF-95 on, and you don't serve it on the local post office. You serve it on the office in Washington. I think that's what's required for appropriate service. And I know that doesn't support my client, but with all candor to the court, I think that's what's required.
Wasn't this point determined by the prior panel? Didn't the prior panel rule on this very point?
Yes. I think that was the basis for the dismissal, that the SF-95 had not been filed within the statute of limitations.
For purposes of a federal action, an action initiated in federal court, not for one initiated in state court that the Attorney General then removes to federal court.
And I think that's really the purpose of the Westfall Act, though, is that to allow a relation back to the commencement date of the action when the unknowing plaintiff files in state court, then finds out after the running of the statute of limitations that this is actually a federally supported entity subject to federal law. Case gets dismissed without prejudice, which is what we're requesting here. And then you file your SF-95 with the appropriate agency. It relates back to the original date that you commenced your action in state court. You wait your 60 days or whatever the statute says until it's either denied or ignored, and then you can move forward with your case on the merits.
So, but if that Westfall Act Savings Clause does not apply to you, then you're out of luck, right? Because the Westfall Act Savings Clause says when the United States is substituted as the party defendant under this subsection. And I'm not sure there's been that pure substitution as much as there's been a deeming of the action against the United States. But any way we look at it, that didn't happen under that subsection, that's 2679D. So if the Westfall Act Savings Clause doesn't apply, then you're out of luck. The statute reads in a very inequitable way at one level because people who don't know are just totally out of luck, but you and your client would be included in that set of people.
I would agree with that, but I would submit that the Westfall Act does apply in this case, and it's not cited in our briefs, but I would direct the court to two cases out of the Seventh Circuit. The first is Arroyo versus U.S. It's 656 F3rd 663. It's a 2011 Seventh Circuit case. It involved a medical malpractice claim against doctors who were deemed employees of the Public Health Service under the FSHCAA. And the court in that case said that the two-year statute of limitations is loosened by the FTCA savings provision under Section 2679D5 of the FTCA. That decision is then followed by Brooks versus HHS Medical, which is a 2021 Southern District of Illinois case, in which the court stated courts have operated on the presumption that the Westfall Act applies to FSHCAA cases. And that Brooks case actually cites the first Knapp case for the proposition that the Third Circuit has not made a determination as to whether the Westfall Act applies or doesn't apply.
So help us think about how, if that's so, how you get there under the terms of the statute. Because you know, as Judge Fitz has pointed out, we've got under 233C, we've got a more limited provision. It takes care of the certification and the deeming it of an action against the United States, and then says that. It's an action brought against the United States under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto. So should we be thinking about this as that clause sweeping in the substitute, both the substitution and removal provisions along with the Westfall Act? Or should we be thinking about it as part of the remedy that's provided, in which case you have to grapple with Huey and the court's unwillingness to bring the Westfall Act in as part of remedy?
I would submit, Your Honor, that when the statute says under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto, that brings in the whole thing. And I think that's what the Seventh Circuit is deciding as well, that if these doctors, these healthcare entities, are going to be given the protections of the Federal Tort Claims Act, then with those protections come the provisions that allow an unwilling or an unknowing plaintiff to save their action under the Westfall Act. And if you think about it, I would submit that would make more sense. This isn't a case where the Knapps are suing a doctor who treated them at a Veterans Administration hospital, where they should know going in there that these are federal employees. This isn't a case like I referenced before where you're involved in a motor vehicle accident with a driver who's driving a Postal Service truck, where you should recognize that these are federal employees. In this case, the NAPS go to the Pike County Health Center and see Nurse Aronson with no knowledge of the fact that the center is a federally funded center or that the nurse is working for a federally funded center. They think they're just going to their doctor's office for treatment. And that's why when the case is originally filed, it's filed as the NAPS versus Nurse Aronson and Pike County Health Center in the Pike County Court of Common Pleas as a medical malpractice action, and not filed as the NAPS versus the United States in a Federal Tort Claims Act action in federal court. So the circumstances lend themselves, I would submit, more to what the Westfall Act is trying to protect against, which is that unknowing plaintiff who goes to their doctor thinking that it's just the doctor at the county health system without knowing that they're federally funded, and only learns later, and in this case, more than 2 years later after the alleged malpractice, that, hey, this is a federally funded health center, and therefore there are steps that you need to take to preserve your action.
So the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto, you're having to do the work of bringing in exhaustion. That's where you think exhaustion comes in, and substitution and removal, and the Westfall Act.
Correct.
So if that is so sweeping and basically brings in everything that you know, from that section, would that include a Bivens action, the availability of a Bivens action?
No, because the FTCA restricts it as well. There's a restriction in the FTCA of the types of cases that you can bring. So that if the FTCA restricts the types of cases that you can bring, and I think you're referring to the Hui matter? The Hui matter says the FTCA doesn't allow a Bivens action. So if it's not allowed, that's a restriction on the plaintiff. It's not allowed. But in exchange for that restriction, that a healthcare provider under the FSHCAA is getting, they also need to be held to the benefit for the plaintiff, so to speak, of the savings clause of the Westfall Act.
So can I pick up? I mean, this is very interesting to me, but that same clause that Judge Krause is asking you about, and she said, hey, you're reading this in a way that sweeps really broadly. I mean, when we say deemed, when this section 233 says deemed a tort action, right? There's no real modifiers on that. If the statute read deemed a presented tort action or a tort action that meets with the presentment requirements, then we'd know that it doesn't sweep in presentment. But right now it's silent on that. And so we have to kind of do a little bit of statutory interpretation to find out whether deeming something a tort action deems it a presented tort action or an unpresented tort action. And it seems that you have taken the position throughout that it deems it as an unpresented tort action for which presentment still applies. But at one level, the easiest way for you to win this case, I think, now it's a legal argument, you have to prevail in a legal argument, would be to say that deeming of it a tort action is deeming it a tort action on the other side of presentment. So my client and I never had to present, and consequently I've just got a live claim that can be removed into federal court, no presentment requirement.
And Your Honor, are you using presentment as it relates to the filing of the SF-95?
Yes, that's exactly right.
I think that because it's deemed a tort action under the provisions of Title 28, that presentment requirement remains.
But I guess what I'm saying is, why isn't it deemed a tort action? Because you can't commence a tort action under Title 28 unless you present it, right? You can't institute one against the federal government unless you present. That's a provision. And so I guess what I'm saying is if we're going to deem something a tort action, why doesn't that say, well, we've deemed it a presented tort action because you can't commence a tort action, as we know from NAP 1, the Third Circuit, you know, the first case, you can't do that in federal court unless you present first. And so I guess the question is when there's a Section 233 certification and removal, why don't we, I mean, it strikes me that you've got a good potential argument that that should deem it as a presented tort action, not one that still has presentment requirements associated with it.
Well, and again, as I said before, if that's what you want to decide and that works for us, that's fine. But I just don't think that my reading of the statutes, my reading of the case law, excuses that presentment requirement. And the reason for that is that's really the basis for the Westfall Act, is that, you know, it may not be the best judicial economy, but the Westfall Act allows the defendant to then come in and say, hey, we removed this. It was never presented. It was the SF-95 form was never presented to the appropriate agency. This should be dismissed on failure to exhaust grounds, but allows the plaintiff to then say, well, wait a second, we didn't know that you were federally funded. We didn't know that this was going to end up in federal court. We didn't know that this federally supported health care centers assistance act applied. So yes, we didn't file our SF-95, but we should now be given the chance to do so. So dismiss us without prejudice. Allow us to file our SF-95. Maybe the case goes away. Maybe the case gets resolved. But in the event that it doesn't, everything relates back to the initial commencement of the action in state court.
But you're talking about the theory of the Westfall Savings Clause, not the application here, right? Because you didn't stand in the shoes of the hypothetical plaintiff you just talked about, right? Your client wasn't unknowing in the way that you're anticipating or arguing that a typical person using the Westfall Savings Clause would be, right?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that at the time the Pike County action was commenced with the filing of the writ of summons, our client was unknowing that the Pike County Health System and Nurse Aronson were covered under the FSHCAA. We only found that out after that writ was filed and served. The writ was served, and then a partner in my office got a call from an attorney at a private firm that said, hey, this is under the FSHCAA. And that writ remained outstanding. We sent the SF-95, albeit to the apparently the wrong entity. It should have been sent to the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington. It was sent to the agency in Pike County, and that was the basis of the dismissal in NAP 1. But all during that time, the writ in Pike County remained on the docket with a docket number having been served, with no action taken by the plaintiff to file a complaint, and importantly, no action taken by the defendant to rule us to file a complaint. And it was after NAP 1 was decided that we went back and said, okay, well, now we have to file a complaint in the Pike County case, which leads us down the road that gets us here.
Looking back at the original opinion here, granted it was a non-presidential opinion, but do we have the same problem there that we're grappling with the district court here, and at least, you know, as regards your arguments? That is, if the panel of our court we're holding, if it's actually part of the holding and not just dictum, that there was never exhaustion, because there was never service at all, then how could the court make a ruling on timeliness grounds when there should have been lack of jurisdiction?
The ruling that we were seeking at the district court was that there was a lack of jurisdiction because of the failure to submit the SF-95 when the action was commenced in state court, but that the...
I'm talking about the original, the federal action, the original action in this court, prior Third Circuit.
The prior...
opinion.
How was there subject matter jurisdiction in that action?
Was there subject matter jurisdiction? If we take the court's reference to there never having been exhaustion, was there subject matter jurisdiction for the district court or for us to opine on the timeliness of filing?
I think that the district court in that case determined that the exhaustion was untimely because it got to the Department of Health and Human Services through whatever channels it got to them more than 2 years after the date that the alleged malpractice occurred. So,
but our opinion, again, granted a non-precedential opinion, makes the statement that there was never exhaustion. It was never served. In that case, there wouldn't be subject matter jurisdiction, right?
Which would lead to the same result, that if there was never exhaustion and it was never served, then, well, I don't know if it leads to the same result or not. I'll be honest. I don't know the answer to that, because I'm thinking in this case, it leads to the result that the Westfall Act can operate to allow for exhaustion relating back to the filing of the writ. In that case, because it was originally filed in federal court without exhaustion, I don't know that there would be subject matter jurisdiction based upon that, but I think it's apples and oranges, because in NAP 1, the case was originally filed in federal court under the Federal Tort Claims Act. In the case that brings us here today, it was originally filed in state court with a writ of summons, and at that point, the plaintiffs were unknowing that the exhaustion requirement was out there.
So is your position that there's there's no res judicata effect to anything that the prior panel ruled upon?
Correct, because it's a different procedural mechanism that we're dealing with here. None of those
rulings are affect what we're to determine here today.
I don't think that the ultimate ruling today is affected by NAP 1, because we're dealing with if the court determines that the Westfall Act applies and we're allowed then to present our SF-95 to the Department of Human Services in Washington, that presentment date will relate back to the filing of the writ, which was sometime in May of 2017, which is within the 2-year statute of limitations.
Well, here's what I'd love you to comment on. I think I follow your argument, but I just want to bring one thing up. In what we're referring to as NAP 1, let's see now. Give me a second. I want to give you a page just so there'll be a reference. It's page 3 of the Westlaw version, and page 90. Sorry, page 90 of the reporter. It is, as Judge Krause said, a not precedential opinion. It says in the last paragraph, even with that knowledge, appellants failed to present their claim to the appropriate federal agency. We talked about that, HHS, and their arguments that the Westfall Act saves their claim lacks merit. That determination should have no effect on our ruling here today, because the focal point of that one was the federal action, as opposed to here, where we begin with the writ of summons. That's your argument?
Correct.
Can we go back for a second to what we're to make of the reference in 233 to the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto? If I understood you correctly before, in response to my question about, so does it sweep in Bivens, you seem to be saying that it couldn't under the FTCA, but the FTCA provides a carve-out, an exception to be able to bring a Bivens action, right, under 2679B2. It was the Supreme Court saying it wasn't going to read that in to the FSHCAA because it was only going to read in as much as there was a remedy provided. How do we make that distinction with, if we're going to rely on this language, the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto, and you say that means it brings in exhaustion, it brings in substitution, it brings in removal, and it brings in this provision of the Westfall Act. What do we do with the Hui decision and the court's, again, the court's unwillingness to read in other significant portions of the Westfall Act? What's the difference?
Honestly, I don't know that I have an answer to that, Your Honor. I think that when you're looking at it as it's deemed a tort action against the U.S., that's the same thing that happens under the FTCA. If the plaintiff...
But deeming, is your position that deeming is the same as substituting?
Well, it requires substitution. It requires removal and then substitution.
Because of this language, you're saying that it brings that portion of the FTCA in by virtue of reference to the provisions of Title 28. There's nothing about substitution in Section 233, right?
Right, but I mean, that's exactly what happened here. The U.S. Attorney's Office removed it under the FSHCAA and then substituted the United States as the defendant.
How do we read in the savings clause, as you would have us do, without reading in a Bivens carve-out?
Again, I think that when you look at, for example, Arroyo in the Seventh Circuit, they determined that the 2-year statute of limitations applicable in that case, which was a case very factually similar to this, is loosened by the savings provision of the Westfall Act. The Brooks case in the Southern District of Illinois held the same thing. And again, I think that when you look at the facts, it makes sense that that should be carved out here because of the fact that it's more likely that a plaintiff filing suit against a doctor, a nurse, a facility under who's unknowingly federally funded is potentially going to run afoul of the exhaustion requirement and therefore need the protection of the Westfall Act. Congress could have said the Westfall Act doesn't apply under FSHCA.
Can I just pick up on one thing in this 2679? This is 2679D1. I don't know if you have this in front of you or not. I'll read it. Right.
Thank you.
This is what it says. It basically says, and I'm going to
I'm going to paraphrase in places. Well, maybe not. Upon certification of the Attorney General that the defendant employee was acting within the scope of his or her office, of his office or employment at the time of the incident out of which the claim arose, any civil action or proceeding commenced upon such a claim in a United States district court says this. I'm going to add in a one. One shall be deemed an action against the United States under the provisions of this title and all references thereto. It sounds really, really similar to 233C. But then it has a second provision. And the United States shall be substituted as the party defendant. And so that suggests to me that deeming and substitution are not the same thing. Because I have one provision that says we'll be deemed, and I have another provision saying the United States will be substituted. And so it's weird if we read 233 as saying shall be deemed an action without any reference to substitution, to then say, oh, we're going to now incorporate that substitution provision of 2679, because it would suggest that Congress, in enacting 233, just chose not to have the substitution part. Because if it wanted to just reference all of Title 28 thereto, it wouldn't need the deeming language. So it's weird that it put in the deeming language, but not the substitute language. See what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying, but respectfully, I would disagree. I think that once it's deemed an action under 2679, once Section 233 deems it an action under 2679, you then have to look to 2679 to see what the requirements are. And the requirements of 2679 are, shall be removed to federal court, and the defendant shall be substituted.
But right now, we don't know if those follow-up consequences in 2679 arise from the deeming or from the substitution. We know that 2679 has both, and we know as a result of that, there are follow-on consequences. But what we don't know is if those follow-on consequences come from the deeming or from the substitution. And if they come from the substitution only, and 233 doesn't have substitution, then those follow-on consequences might not apply. Yes? There's a few ifs in there. You can push back against the ifs, but if that's the path, I mean...
I guess, but respectfully, I would say that once it's deemed an action under 2679, 2679 comes in for the purposes of the procedure of substitution. And that's exactly what happened here.
But not for purposes of a Bivens action.
Correct.
And then the question I've been concerned about is then not, I guess, for purposes of presentment, but I mean, it's weird because it's for some but not others, right? Not for Bivens action, for presentment, and yeah. I mean, if anything, Hui says we're going to look at this kind of carefully in terms of what we loop in and what we don't loop in, and so you would maybe expect a little more direction on anything that would be expected to be looped in, is I guess what I'm saying. But your position is it encompasses everything except the Bivens action?
I think so, because the Bivens action has been carved out by the court in Hui.
Well, it's carved out with the idea that what's in is a remedy, is the remedy. So is removal substitution part of a remedy? Is the savings clause part of a remedy? If so, how?
I don't think that those are part of the remedy. I think those are part of the procedure. But I think that the procedure is necessary under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is what these cases are deemed to proceed under.
Well, your argument then, if and I don't mean to quibble over words, but the court says that it does bring in these provisions insofar as they relate to a remedy. What you're saying that these procedures are part of that remedy, but that the Bivens is not, that it's in the nature of a more of a substantive action or something different than the remedy. Is that right?
Yes, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. I just have one other question. One of the things that the Westfall Savings Clause asks is that within 60 days of dismissal, there's the essentially the submission of the SF-95 to the appropriate agency.
Right.
There have been several dismissals here, various reasons. I don't want to go over all of that. I'm just curious, is there a reason that the FS-95 wasn't presented after any of those dismissals?
The dismissal, my understanding of the way the Westfall Act works is that the dismissal has to be without prejudice. The court has to essentially the court is essentially granting leave for the party to file their SF-95. And in this, in NAF 1 and in this case as well, the district court dismissed those cases with prejudice. At the district court level in this case, we specifically requested that the court grant the motion to dismiss.
I know you wanted it.
Right, without prejudice. So the savings clause requires a dismissal without prejudice in order to trigger that 60 days to begin to run.
Right.
And that's why that's our position now, is that the case should be remanded to the court with direction that a dismissal be entered, but the dismissal be without prejudice, so that the 60 days would then begin to run.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, counsel. If you'd turn your microphone on, please. We'd love to chat.
May it please the court, I'm Dana Karasvan for the United States. There's so many interesting issues on the table here. I just want to take a step back and make clear this case has to be dismissed, right? Plaintiffs have conceded this case needs to be dismissed. This is the second suit to reach this court on the same claims. And in the first one, this court held that the administrative claim was not timely and affirmed the district court's dismissal with prejudice. So what we're talking about here is whether the plaintiff can get around the time limit in a third suit about the same claims. I think it won't ultimately matter because the first suit was dismissed with prejudice, but the question of whether the savings clause would apply in that third suit, the court would have to find both that the Westfall Act applies to these federally funded health centers, which it doesn't, just from the text of the statute, and that the precipice was sufficient to commence the suit. So I'd just like to start
you're calling this a third suit, but this is the continuation of the first suit, right? This is the state suit now removed in the federal system, but it's one continuous suit, correct?
So I was calling this a second one because it's the second one. This is the second one to reach this court. But yes, we have this one that started in state court, the other one that started in federal court. But this case has to be dismissed. And the question is whether they can file a third suit. Right. Westfall Savings doesn't save this case. Plaintiffs have conceded, for example, on page 13 of their brief, this case has to be dismissed. And what we're talking about when we talk about Westfall is whether they can file a third lawsuit.
Is it really a third suit? I mean, if the complaint is dismissed without prejudice, aren't they in a position to file another complaint in that suit. It's dismissed without prejudice.
No, Your Honor. So the Supreme Court in McNeil, we may be getting a little too esoteric here, but you know what McNeil says is you have to exhaust your remedies before filing suit. So one case gets dismissed, they exhaust, they file a new suit. So I think it would be a new suit. This case would be dismissed without prejudice, and we would call the third suit a new suit. But this suit does have to be dismissed. And so all we're talking about is what happens if they show up again and file a third complaint.
So you've said this a number of times, that and it was your lead, which is this suit has to be dismissed. Now, you're leveraging heavily a concession, a repeated concession made by your adversary, who basically says as much. But embedded in that, it strikes me, is the assumption that the presentment requirement applies to this case. And it's not obvious to me at all that under the reading of the statutes that the presentment requirement applies. And so I guess what I'm saying is, if the presentment requirement doesn't apply, let me just work with me on this if, right? If that doesn't apply, then this suit doesn't have to be dismissed, right?
We're pretty far out of the world that I've thought about. So let me just take a minute to think that through. So if the presentment requirement didn't apply, no, this case would still need to be dismissed. So there are two things, right? There's the presentment requirement in 2675A, and then there's the time limit in 2401B. We're actually relying on that time limit in 2401B.
But the time limit builds in a presentment requirement. And so I guess what I'm saying is, if we say there was no presentment requirement for purpose of 2679 or for 2401, then this case wouldn't have to be dismissed. It's a big if. I know I expect you to counter that if. But I'm just saying, if that's not there, then this case doesn't have to be dismissed.
I'm not sure what other procedural things would apply if that weren't there. So I don't want to bind the United States on this. No court has ever said that the timing and presentment requirements don't apply to these health center cases. This court applied them, addressed this in NAP 1. And plaintiffs have conceded that.
But to an action initiated in federal court, not to an action initiated in state court, deemed to be a federal action and removed to federal court. And so the question isn't whether the presentment requirements would apply in an action in federal court against the United States. The question is, would the presentment requirement apply to an action in state court against the health center and an employee that the United States then certifies through the HHS certification and the Attorney General certification and now brings into federal court? And that question seems to be much more of an open question and not answered by NAP 1.
So it's an interesting argument, Your Honor. No court has ever held, to my knowledge, that plaintiffs don't have to meet these exhaustion and timing requirements.
There's not a lot of Section 233C litigation either, though, right?
Well, so this court, for example, in there is actually a fair amount of Section 233 litigation, and in every case, the plaintiffs exhaust and have to exhaust. You know, this court in Santos looked at whether equitable tolling applies to this exhaustion requirement. Right there, it was assuming and that the exhaustion requirement applies. I'm just not aware of any court that has ever said that that doesn't apply. And the reason it does is a textual.
Where in the statute, where in 233 do we get that requirement? And if the only place it seems like it could come is from the reference to this being deemed a tort action brought against the United States under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto, which it sounds like you're saying has to incorporate the exhaustion requirement of the FTCA, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but why then wouldn't it incorporate the provisions of the Westfall Act, and in particular the Savings Clause?
So the Westfall Act doesn't apply. That's not suits brought against the United States. That's suits brought against any employee of the government. You can see that over and over in the Westfall Act, in, for example, 2679 C and D. So Westfall applies to suits brought against government employees, whereas this is brought against the United States. So Westfall and the Federally Funded Health Centers Act, these are two different paths with different procedural requirements that get you to a suit against the United States. If this court held that the Westfall Act applies to suits against federally funded health centers, that would have implications that go far beyond this case and beyond the savings clause and change the procedural requirements in terms of removal, right? So just to be clear, so the health centers statute, it's deemed a tort action brought against the United States. Westfall applies to suits brought against any employee of the government, and removed under 2679D. So Westfall doesn't apply to suits brought against the United States. It applies to suits brought against government employees, right? It's a separate path to get a suit against the United States. And, you know, this court did assume in an unpublished decision, Hurtado, that the Westfall Savings Clause applies to these federally funded health center cases, but it's contradicted by the text, and it would have pretty significant implications
How do you reconcile what you're arguing with 233G1A, which says that for purposes of this section, that the physician, the practitioner, shall be deemed an employee of the public health service? I mean, they are to be deemed an employee of the federal government, just as is provided in 2679D1, aren't they?
No, Your Honor. It's only, as you read, for purposes of this section, for purposes of 233, not for purposes of 2679. So you see over and over, it talks about for purposes of this section in 1A and 1B, deemed employee for purposes of this section. Every time it talks about deeming an employee, it makes it clear it's for purposes of this section of 233. So that doesn't bring in 2679. It doesn't make them an employee for purposes of the Westfall Act of 2679 or for, you know, Bivens or federal benefits or anything else. It's only for purposes of 233 that they are deemed an employee.
Is it your position then that the United States doesn't have authority under 233 to substitute in?
No, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure how you got there. So G, for purposes of this section, meaning 233, they're deemed employees, right? And then C says the Attorney General can substitute in for an employee. And under that section of 233, they are an employee. But when we start talking about other sections, like 2679, they're not deemed an employee for purposes of those sections.
Well, what do we make of the language of under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto? Because all 233C provides is for certification, right? It doesn't provide for substitution. It doesn't provide for removal. It doesn't provide for exhaustion. To get those provisions of the FTCA and Westfall in here, don't you need to read them into this section, 233?
No, Your Honor. So 233 actually does provide for removal, and it provides the action is deemed a tort action against the United States. Until today, I've never heard anybody say that that wasn't the same as substitution. So this is a separate path. It's in the second line of my Westlaw printout. Any civil action shall be commenced or proceeding commenced in state court shall be removed without bond at any time before trial by the Attorney General to the district court. And the tort action brought, and this is really key language, right? It's deemed a tort action brought against the United States. So this is a separate path. It's not the Westfall path. It gets you to a tort action against the United States, but you never have a tort action governed by Westfall that is against an actual government employee.
Is the Westfall provision is D1 when it provides for the United States shall be substituted as a party defendant? Is that language simply superfluous?
Until today, yes, Your Honor, until today, I have never heard anybody say that the deeming doesn't also affect substitution. And in cases that are brought under the Health Centers Act, the United States is substituted. It becomes the defendant when the case is deemed to be against the United States. So I'm not aware of substitution doing any additional work there. 233 existed for a long time before the Westfall Act, and it's, you know, my understanding that it's always been that the United States becomes the defendant.
I thought the Westfall Act added the substitution part. I thought that was the point of the Westfall Act, to add the substitution language. That's what wasn't there before, and that's what was the legislative response. Am I wrong? I mean, that's just notional. But am I wrong on that? I thought substitution was not in the original FTCA in 46 and was added in 88. Is that wrong? It's notional, so I could be wrong.
So I'm not as familiar with the Westfall Act, this part of the legislative history, as I probably should be to answer your question, Your Honor. But my understanding is that what Westfall did, it wasn't that this was there, but not the – yes, in fact, I know for sure. It added D entirely. So it's not that it's not that there was a process to deem this a suit against the United States, but they added the substitute language, right? They added all of subsection D.
So let me just do a statutory compare and contrast with you, right? These are sometimes fun. So I'm in subsection 233 section C, and it says, and the preceding deemed a tort action brought against the United States under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto. And so the phrase that I'm really concerned about is deemed a tort action, right? And then we have 28 U.S.C. 2679, and it says, shall be deemed an action against the United States under the provisions of this title and all references thereto, and the United States will be substituted as the party defendant. And so the two big differences between 233, as I can tell, and section 2679 D1 is, one, 233 C says deemed a tort action, which is different than just deeming an action. It seems to do more work than just deeming something an action against the United States. And then two, D1 has this substitution language that you say before today no one's ever paid any attention to. Interesting. But I guess my point is, because 233C deems it a tort action and not just an action, why shouldn't we read that as absolving the presentment requirement? Because in order to bring a tort action, you have to present. And now we're not deeming it just an action that would require presentment. We're actually deeming it a tort action, almost a perfected tort action, one that had been presented. So, I mean, there's a difference in text, but what do you make of that? Is that just Scrivener's error, just inconsequential extra word in the statute that we should ignore?
So, These are all new ideas that I just haven't seen in any court opinion. I want to take them really seriously and just I'm thinking them through on my feet. So let's see. We have the does it by deeming it a tort action eliminate the exhaustion requirement? I just don't see how the tort action could do that. It says an action brought against a tort action brought against the United States under the provisions of Title 28. And then if we go to 2401, it says a tort claim against the United States shall be forever barred unless it is presented in writing to the appropriate federal agency within 2 years after the claim accrues. So it seems to me that this is talking about exactly the same kind of action. In 233, Congress may have felt comfortable using the word tort these all medical malpractice claims that come in through 233. So that might make a difference, that Congress just knew that it was talking about a medical malpractice tort there.
Can I inject a new just another puzzler, at least to me, a statutory puzzler? Let's see what sense you can make of this. I mean, 2679 D4. If you have this in front, if you want, I can read it. But it basically says upon certification, and you know it's its own thing. I know you made strong points that it's different to certify an employee versus an action against the United States. But upon certification, any action proceedings subject to paragraph 1, 2, or 3 shall proceed in the same manner as an action against the United States filed pursuant to section 1346B of this title, and this is the language I'm concerned about, shall be subject to the limitations and exceptions applicable to those actions. That language is missing from section 233. So it suggests that those limitations, one of which might be a statute of limitations, was read into 2679 explicitly. And that is absent from 233. Congress knew how to write this. They wrote it. But they didn't include it in section 233. So they essentially say you will be subject to those statute of limitations. But you didn't say that. They didn't say that with respect to 233. What do you think? I know you're going to tell me I'm misreading something. I just want to know what.
Yes, Your Honor. So 233C has entirely different language, right? In D4 of the Westfall Act, it's deemed an action filed pursuant to 1346B and subject to limitations and exceptions, right? So that's in 1346B and the limitations and exceptions. Whereas 233C is deemed a tort action brought against the United States under the provisions of Title 28 and all references thereto. So that brings in everything in Title 28 that applies to a tort action against the United States.
But not the Westfall Act Savings Clause.
No, because the Westfall Act Savings Clause does not apply to tort actions brought against the United States. It only applies to tort actions brought against defendant employees and repealed under 2679.
What has to happen though is this. You've said that until today you've never heard of a difference between deeming and substitution, right? Until today, never heard. But the Westfall Act provision, this D5, talks about an action or proceeding in which the United States is substituted is the party defendant. And here, there's not a substitution, but a deeming. And so, if these are different contexts, then it strikes me that if substitute and deeming are not coextensive and synonyms, then it seems that really what you're saying is D5 doesn't apply because the United States isn't substituted as a party.
So, that could be another reason that D5 does not apply. I don't know what you call it, though, when the case shows up in federal court and the defendant is changed from being the health center to being the United States. I think that's just called substitution, and that's what happens. So So I just don't.
It's just weird, though. It's weird that Congress would go out of its way to use two different phraseologies and treat them differently, as if, and then say they mean the exact same thing, and substitute is the exact same thing as deeming, and therefore some of the references to both just must be totally superfluous. That's kind of the canon against superfluity says don't do that.
So I hear what you're saying, Your Honor. I do think that the way that this operated before the Westfall Act was that it was people, the cases were removed and the captions were substituted. This question of whether this suit had to be, whether plaintiff had to exhaust their administrative remedies was decided, of course, in NAP 1, and both claim and issue preclusion would apply to that decision. But plaintiff hasn't made this argument, and no other court, as far as I'm aware, has said that this difference makes this kind of difference. And I think that it makes sense in terms of how these statutes developed that they have the language that they have.
Well, I mean, in terms of how the statutes developed, I mean, that cuts against you a lot, because the Westfall Act is designed to give people an extent, a kind of an extra crack at a cause of action. And the way that this is working, if the Westfall Act doesn't apply here, then there's no extra crack at a cause of action. So if we want to get into the purpose of the Westfall Act and what the Westfall Act is trying to do, and that its savings clause definitely is trying to give people another crack at the action when they sue the wrong person or when they don't present, and it seems strange to say let's look at that to talk about these differences and give context to these differences, but let's ignore that text when it comes to the harsh reality that if the savings clause doesn't apply, then this case was dead a long time ago. Right?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. So in terms of whether it makes sense that Congress did it this way, I think it does make sense, right? In the Federally Funded Health Centers Assistance Act, which postdated Westfall, Congress put the United States on the hook for all of the medical malpractice liability that happens at these health centers, and it put limitations in place. And while with a federal employee, you know, you can get in a car accident with somebody and not know until you file suit that they're a government employee within the scope of employment. But for health centers, HHS maintains a database. It's now available on their website. And the Seventh Circuit has said it's, you know, not asking too much of the medical malpractice bar to know to check this website. And any fairness concerns that are there, the equitable tolling framework, as this court said in Santos, still applies. We just don't have fairness concerns here, because as the district court said in NAP 1, equitable tolling doesn't apply. This is a situation which the health center called plaintiff and told them they needed to proceed via the FTCA about 3 weeks before their SF-95 would have been due, their administrative claim would have been due. And the district court in the case that I'm calling NAP 1, the case that started in federal court, said, you know, that was ample time and they would have figured out what they needed to do with some basic research. So these concerns that motivated the Westfall Act, I just don't think are there to the same degree for health centers where there's this database that medical malpractice lawyers can check to find out if their medical malpractice claim involves a federally funded health center.
Let me ask you one question as a follow-up on this Westfall Act conversation that we've been having. I think in your papers you talk about the fact that with regard to the dismissals that have occurred, there's been there's been no presentment to HHS following them within 60 days. Your adversary, I think when I asked him about that, said, well, that wouldn't have happened because in those instances, those dismissals were with prejudice, and the fact that they were with prejudice would have precluded any presentment to follow within 60 days. Could you just speak to that issue for a moment?
I'm afraid that on this I am confused because I actually had thought that they did file another administrative claim after the district court's decision. That's not in the record here, though, and I could be wrong about that. I'm not actually sure. I apologize.
You're not sure about the with prejudice whether, without prejudice?
I'm sure it should be with prejudice. What I'm not sure about is whether the time for filing the administrative claim, whether that 60 days started running when the district court issued its decision or would start running if plaintiff prevailed here. I just don't know the answer to when that 60 days starts to run. I would submit that it doesn't matter because the Westfall Act can't apply to this suit and because both because of the text of the Westfall Act and because of the commencement issue. And also in a third case, even if this one is dismissed without prejudice, we do have that prior dismissal with prejudice that it goes to the same claims as plaintiff is bringing here. So I would think claim preclusion would also apply in a that's all to say, I apologize, Your Honor, I just haven't looked into the question of whether they need to have filed after the district court decision or whether they could still file in a case where the Westfall Act apply after this court's opinion.
All right.
On the applicability of the Westfall Act, in these healthcare center cases, it appears in the case law that the government sometimes removes under 2679D and sometimes removes under 233. Is it up to the government then which of these applies and whether as a result the Westfall Act and Savings Clause applies?
No, Your Honor. 2679 never applies. Sometimes people make mistakes. But these cases have to be removed under 233. And this case was removed under 233. You can see that at JA 24. And Westfall just doesn't provide for removal of cases that aren't against government employees. And so the fact that somebody makes a mistake in the removal papers doesn't change that. As I said, these are separate paths to get to an FTCA suit against the United States. And while confusion, this is very technical and confusion is understandable, but only 233 applies.
We haven't given you much opportunity to talk about commencement as a state or federal law matter. Do you want to speak to that at least briefly?
Certainly, Your Honor. So this is a federal statute. Commencement should be then determined by federal law. We're looking at the purpose of the statute, which is to provide fairly prompt notice and a uniform rule, right? This two-year period applies everywhere in every state. It just can't be in that scheme that you can file something, sit on it for years. This was 3 years, but there's no limit in Pennsylvania law. It could have been 3 or 5 or 10 or who knows, and then resuscitate your suit. When courts were looking at how claim accrual decided, whether that was a state or federal question, as the Second Circuit said, it would be inimical to the design of FTCA's scheme to allow a rule, a state rule, to subject the United States to this kind of stale claims that the prescription of this short period was intended to avoid. And whatever it means to commence, it just can't be this. This precipice doesn't say anything, right? All it says is kindly issue a summons in civil action in the above action. It doesn't say what the action is, as this court noticed in Sikorica. The defendant doesn't have to show up in response to it. The defendant can't remove in response to it. It's not considered a pleading under Pennsylvania state law, Rule 10-17. There's no way to get to judgment without a complaint. So whatever commencement means, whatever Congress meant by commence a suit, it just can't have meant something like this.
Well, just, you know, 1346B1 says, you know, the United States is, you know, liable under the FTCA if a private person would be liable to the claimant in accordance with the law of the place where the act or omission occurred. So it seems strange to make a huge push for uniformity, right, in a statute that basically says we're going to take the law of each state. Like, it would strike me that maybe in accordance with the law of the place where the act or omission occurred, and we want to look at what occurred means, would be very close to what accrual means, right? And those aren't too different. But then it seems strange to make a play for uniformity when the entire arc of this statute is about using state law as a basis for making the federal government liable. And to boot, just in case that's not enough, I know you could tell me that Westlock doesn't matter, but when you make a scope certification and you look whether something is in the scope of a federal officer's or employee's employment, you don't look to federal law. You look to state law. So it strikes me as really, really amazing to say, oh, everything we're doing looks at state law except for commencement of an action. There. We need to look to exclusively federal law. That's a little out of step with everything else I know about the FTC. Tell me why that's wrong.
Yes, Your Honor. So, but I'm not going to tell you that we don't care about Westfall here, because we are only talking about commencement if we get to the point where Westfall applies. It doesn't. But this is the Westfall Act that we're talking about, and so we do care about the Westfall Act if we get to the point where we're looking at the Westfall Act. Okay, so the Westfall Act does matter, but what the Westfall Act does is it sets up a regime in which the law applies, but the time limits come from federal law, from 2401, right? So we have state substantive law, federal time limits.
Federal time limits only with respect to presentment, not with respect to commencement of a civil action.
No, Your Honor. So 2401A says the tort claim shall be forever barred unless it's presented within 2 years after such claim accrues, right? So that is the time limit, which is a uniform time limit. It applies in every case. And as all of the courts looking at when a claim accrues said, it just can't be that we can allow the state to do indirectly what the state can't do directly by extending that period of time, that 2 years, beyond the 2 years that Congress provided. So that's why we have federal claim accrual rules. If this counted, the 2 years would become meaningless,
it's,
right?
Or it's almost as if Section 233 does not want to account for the presentment requirement in 2401. That's another inference. Now no one's ever made that before. I know you're going to be quick to tell me that, but that is another inference that could be made.
So wait, Your Honor, 233 is totally separate from the Westfall Act, right?
Right.
So 233 doesn't tell us. We don't look at 233 when we're trying to decide what commencement means in the Westfall Act. But we are looking at the regime that governs suits against the United States, right? We have a waiver of sovereign immunity. Congress waived sovereign immunity. Now we're talking only about Westfall, only about federal employees. But Congress waived sovereign immunity for these torts against federal employees acting within scope. And Congress, in that waiver, says, you know, we have these limitations, including 2401, which tells us the time limit. The language that Your Honor was reading to me earlier in D4 tells us, you know, Congress did definitely want this time limit to apply in suits against federal employees, right? So we have this time limit, we know, and the time limit is a federal time limit. It applies to everybody. And that gets these cases then to the attention of the Attorney General within 2 years. That just would not happen if we had a world in which somebody could file a precipe and then just let it sit for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, who knows, without any kind of action, without anything that tells the Attorney General that this is the kind of case that would be deemed a suit against the United States, right? So it just can't be that this kind of thing that could extend the limitations period indefinitely is the kind of thing that Congress meant to sweep in. This also doesn't, I want to be careful with Erb versus Pitcairn, because that predated the federal rules. And of course, now we have Federal Civil Procedure 3, which tells us what commence means. But even looking at that language, that was the pre-Rule 3 world, where somebody first filed a complaint and then served. So Erb versus Pitcairn was after complaint. And this isn't something, the precipe isn't something that puts the defendant on a path to the right court, because the defendant can't remove it and the defendant doesn't have to show up at all. So however you want to think about this, this precipe does nothing. It's certainly, you know, whatever the Westfall Savings Act was intended to do, it wasn't intended to give a plaintiff an additional bite at the apple. It was for people who didn't know where they were supposed to sue, who they were supposed to sue, which of course isn't have here. You know, nothing in Westfall Savings is designed to let people bring multiple suits.
Just to clarify, 2401A is a 6-year statute of limitations from accrual, right?
Yes, Your Honor, we're looking at 2401B, which applies to tort claims.
But that's on presentment to the appropriate federal agency, right?
It has the time limit. So barred unless it's presented in writing to the federal agency within 2 years after such claim accrues. So that's actually where that time limit comes from. 2675A and 2401B work together. You have to present first. You have to present within 2 years. You can't file then if you keep going in 2401B. The action has to be begun within 6 months after the date of mailing of the final denial of the claim. So that tells you all of the how all the time limits fit together. So you have to file your claim within 2 years. You can wait for that claim. 2675A tells you if you wait, you have to wait at least 6 months. You don't have to. You can construe it as denied, but then once you get a denial, then you have to file your suit within 6 months. So that sets out this whole limitations period under federal law, which of course would really be undermined if we could have a system in which somebody files something that doesn't tell us what the suit is about, that isn't enough for the Attorney General to come in and remove and substitute, and then can just sit on the...
Basically what you're doing, though, is you're disparaging Pennsylvania's system, right? You're saying that's a horrible system. Please don't apply it to the United States, right? But that's Pennsylvania's system. And if state law applies, your grievance is just you don't like Pennsylvania's system, right? But 233C suggests that we're looking at when something is commenced in state court. And you rejoined that no, FRCP 3 tells us when an action is commenced, but FRCP 1 tells us that the federal rules only apply to proceedings in federal court, not those in state court. And so 233C is already saying something not governed by the federal rules because it's in state court. So, I mean, it almost seems that what you're trying to say is Pennsylvania's system doesn't work. We don't like this this precipice system. You can't apply it to the federal government. Well, I mean, if we're to look to state law for when something commences, and we look to state law for just about everything else in this tort space, then it's strange to me that it wouldn't be the filing of the precipice, and the United States would have all of the remedies that any other defendant would have in Pennsylvania who receives a precipice. They could file their own precipice saying, please, file a complaint. And if the plaintiff didn't file a complaint within 20 days, then they lose their case. That's not that bad. Nothing is causing anyone to wait for years and years and years, asking you to wait 20 days. Seems a lot better than 2 years under presentment.
So I'd like to say four things to respond to that, Your Honor, and I hope I remember them all. The first is that we'll look at 233 to interpret the Westfall Act, right? We're talking about the Westfall Act. We're only looking at the Westfall Act. But you could make the same point looking at the language of the Westfall Act. I'm not disparaging Pennsylvania law. What I'm doing is looking at a waiver of sovereign immunity of the United States, which needs to be read narrowly, which has certain procedural requirements attached. We don't look to state law to figure out the time limits. We don't look to state law to figure out when the time starts in terms of accrual. There's no reason that we would allow a state law procedure to, for the same reasons that we do that, we shouldn't allow a state law procedure to blow up the end of this period and let it go on indefinitely. Now, Your Honor said there's no problem with making the Attorney General show up in state court, but the Attorney General doesn't litigate tort suits in state court. And the thing about the precipice, as this court recognized in Sicarica, is it doesn't have any information. It doesn't tell us if this is a case where the Attorney General should be defending or if this is a case where the health center needs to get its own counsel. So either we have the Attorney General showing up litigating cases in state court that may or may not be, at least filings in state court that may or may not be cases about the government, or we have health centers doing exactly what the Health Center Act is designed to prevent and having to get their own counsel.
But there's no deadline like there is in 1446, right? I mean, Sicarica, we were concerned with that removal statute, with the deadline. So yeah, you got to know, but also with a rule that talks about setting forth a claim for relief. We don't have here a particular deadline, right? There could be removal under 233 when it's apparent that certification is warranted. And there's nothing that suggests that commencement needs to be in connection with notice about the nature of the claim.
So, Your Honor, I only pointed to Sicarica as an example of a place where the court recognized that the precipice is insufficient to give notice for the defendant. What we're looking at here with this federal statute and this waiver of sovereign immunity, one of the things that tells us this can't be the kind of thing that Congress was looking at, is thinking of, is that the precipice is not sufficient to give notice to the government what this claim is about. It's not sufficient to allow the government in that relatively short period set out by the 2 years, it's not sufficient to allow the government to figure out that this is a tort action against the United States.
What 2 year deadline applies as against the United States?
So that now I'm wondering if I misspoke, but what I was talking about is 2401B says you have to file your administrative claim within 2 years,
that's
right?
That's the plaintiff.
Yes. Oh, yes. So the United States doesn't have a deadline. The United States can remove any time until trial. So it's not, we don't have the problem as in Sicarica where you have to make the decision to remove before the United States could know what this claim is about. But we have a different problem, which is that we have a waiver of sovereign immunity that is set up in a scheme where the United States should know within about 2 years whether there is this claim against the United States. And
so where do you get that from? Where is that two-year deadline for the United States?
Certainly. So just to be clear, the United States should find out because plaintiff should tell them within 2 years. So it's a deadline for plaintiff. Plaintiff has to file their claim within 2 years. And then if it's a suit against the United States governed by you see how people get confused. If it's a suit against a government employee, then they can also file suit in state court within 2 years against the government employee. But it's that same 2 years. And then the government employee has to, I believe it's in D2. The employee has to let the United States, let the Attorney General, the head of its department, know that the suit exists. So all of this is set up to bring these claims to the United States within about 2 years. And as to the United States' attention to the Attorney General within that time period. And that whole scheme, you know, just as the courts all said, looking at claim accrual rules, that whole scheme would be undermined if states could do, I believe I'm quoting the Sixth Circuit here, do indirectly what they can't do directly and use state law rules to get around that two-year requirement. Because Congress only brought in the Congress only brought in the state substantive rules, not the state time limits.
Is your answer, we had cited to you, I'll ask the same question that I had asked of your colleague. The cases that we cited dealing with diversity, CAFA, is your answer you distinguish them solely on the basis of this involving sovereign immunity? Or is there some other reason that we, in all of these other contexts, we're looking to commencement as a matter of state law but not here?
So the reason it comes straight out of Erie that you look to state law for commencement for diversity cases, so Erie and then Walker, the concern there is that you don't want people to have a different time period for filing suit when they file in federal court versus state court. The suit, if you have a good suit, it should be good in either. It should be good in both courts. If it's not good in one court, it shouldn't be good in the other. And that's why the time periods need to be the same in diversity cases. CAFA is also diversity. It just lowers the filing threshold, the amount of money, by allowing you to put claims together. So, and Farina was very clear, right? The court had already held that there was no federal question jurisdiction. That was purely diversity. So in these diversity cases, the idea from Erie is that we need the same result in state court and federal court. Here, we're dealing with something completely different, right? Here, we are dealing with and the goal isn't to get the same result in state court and federal court. This case would never happen in state court. Here, what we're looking at, as that is a waiver of sovereign immunity and making sure that we have the limitations on that waiver that Congress put in place. But the justifications for applying the same rule in terms of the state rule for diversity cases in terms of getting to the same outcome in state and federal court, that just doesn't apply at all in FTCA suits.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. Just to address one of the issues that counsel had raised about the filing of the precipice of the writ of summons and allowing that to sit for 5 or 10 years and then resuscitate the suit. It doesn't resuscitate the suit. The suit doesn't need to be resuscitated because the suit's not dead. It's the suit is filed, it's commenced in state court with the filing of the writ of summons. We're not asking here to extend the 2-year period for commencement of an action. We're not asking to extend the 2-year period for presentment of the action to the Department of Health and Human Services.
You're not asking for it, but isn't that the practical result?
Well, if it's the practical result, it's because that's what the Westfall Act is designed to do, is to relate back to that commencement of the action for the determination that the presentment of the action, the SF-95 form, is determined to be presented on the date that the state suit was filed. That's what the statute says. But it doesn't extend the statute of limitations. If we waited until 2 years and one day to file a precipice for writ of summons against Nurse Aronson and the Pike County Health Center, we wouldn't be here because it would be clear that the statute of limitations had expired 2 years and one day after the date of the alleged malpractice. Here, I don't think there's any argument by the defense that the writ of summons was untimely filed as it relates to statute of limitations. So it doesn't extend the statute of limitations. It extends, the Westfall Act extends the time for the presentment of the SF-95 form. But we would still be within those 2 years.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Please rise. This court stands adjourned.